Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I keep singing that song, "It's a Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood." I need it on tape to put it in the car today to keep singing it. That was a fun hour. And we're going to have a great hour this hour, too. Scott Simon is with us this hour. Scott is an enormously talented human being. He has a new novel. It is titled Windy City, a novel of politics, which takes place, of course, in Chicago, and is a terrific read. It's a novel of politics. Did I say that? That's the subtitle of the book. And it weaves together, you know, Chicago politics. The mayor of Chicago is found in his office late at night. He's sitting in his boxer shorts. He's face down, dead in a pizza. He's a very interesting character. And at the center is an equally interesting character who's alderman of the 48th Ward and vice mayor. And he just takes in so much here. All kinds of characters, lots of aldermen. Obviously, the scandal here, he looks at – he just knows this city so well. It's phenomenal. Restaurants and the subway and how politics work, you know, what the rewards are. Scott is host now of Weekend Edition Saturday, which I really think is one of the better – if not the best radio program on. It's just wonderful. He joined NPR in 1977 as chief of the Chicago Bureau and obviously remembers – well, he grew up in Chicago too and a few other cities, but a lot of time in Chicago, so he knows the city very well. He's reported from all 50 states. He's covered presidential campaigns and 8 wars. He's reported from Central America, Africa, India, the Middle East, and the Caribbean. Covered the war in Afghanistan for NPR, has reported from Cuba, from Ethiopia on that country's famine and prolonged civil war, from the Middle East during the Gulf War, and from the siege of Sarajevo and the destruction of Kosovo. He's received many awards for his work, including a Peabody Award for his weekly radio essays, an award in 79 for coverage of the American Nazi Party rally in Chicago, and a Unity Award in media in 78 for political reporting on All Things Considered. He's narrated the documentary film Lincoln of Illinois for PBS, which should be, you know, this is his anniversary, bicentennial. That should be on again this year, I would imagine. He's hosted many television programs. He's written other books, and we've interviewed him on his memoir of a fan, Jackie Robinson and the Integration of Baseball. His first novel, Pretty Birds, about female teenage snipers in Sarajevo. He and his wife have 2 children, and he's been busy on that front as well. And he's going to be in Milwaukee tomorrow, so we'll tell you all about him. Boy, that took a while. You've done too many things, Scott.
Well, I'm glad you got to our 2 little girls. They're absolutely the best thing. How are you?
Aren't they the best? I'm all right. I'm all right. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. You know, I parenthetically, I actually began my book tour with Windy City. I'm in Chicago now, in Pittsburgh. And just yesterday,
oh my gosh,
at the hotel in Chicago, Fred Rogers, the company that survived him, Family Communications, airlifted me a red Fred Rogers zipper cardigan to wear today.
Oh, Scott, you're kidding.
No,
what
I've
a wonderful thing.
I've got a new appearance at Borders on South State Street, and I'm going to wear it.
Oh, will you wear it tomorrow in Milwaukee, too? Or will it be dirty by then?
It'll be a little dirty, but I'll wear it at some point,
that
sure.
That would be nice. Did you know him?
I did. I can't. We would call each other friends, and I can't. You know, I can't say we spent a lot of social time with each other. But whenever I was in Pittsburgh, I would drop by and see Fred. And then, you know, inevitably, a lot of what we do in public broadcasting, as I don't have to tell you, is fundraising. And Fred and I were thrown together on, you know, at least a dozen fundraising occasions. And always very warm, just wonderful to talk to him. And I will never forget him. We were in San Diego. It was the opening of a new facility for KPBS, both radio and television. And we were both speaking or making some kind of presentation. And my cat, Lenore, had died maybe a couple weeks before, and I had done an essay on the air. And of all the things he could say to me and of all the things people were saying to me, it was Fred who came over and very tenderly and gently said, "I'm so sorry to hear about Lenore Scott." He was a wonderful man, just wonderful.
You know, I think of you and the kind of broadcasting you do, and I think about his statement about the sacred space between the microphone and the person on the other side. I think you treat what you do with that kind of care as well, which I mean is just an ultimate compliment to you. You're so good at that. So good.
Thank you. Some weeks are better than others.
I are a little humble, too.
Some days might be better than others.
Yeah. So you obviously have this great fascination and affection for Chicago. You know this city like nobody's business. Woo, do you know this city?
Well, I hope so, but you know, it's interesting because we're doing a round of interviews here in Chicago after hitting a couple of eastern cities, and of course, the subject always comes up that I haven't actually lived in Chicago for a few years
right.
at this particular point, to say the least. And you know, although I'm here a lot during the year, and my mother still lives here in Chicago, and we make it a point of coming to Chicago, and it's very nice because a lot of community groups and organizations and fundraising enterprises here have made it a point to, well, you know, to ask me to come in and include us in there. So we feel connected to this community, but actually haven't lived here for a while. And I would tell you that it sharpens your eye for when you actually have to write a novel set in Chicago. I think if we were living here, which is nothing I would ever want to rule out for our future, particularly now that we have such a literary stake in the history of this city. I think it helps you appreciate the ways, I think it helps you appreciate what's remarkable about the place and distinctive and unique, because we have been around the world and have lived in different places, including really so many of the great cities of the world. So it makes you appreciate Chicago and what makes it distinctive and humorous all the more.
Right. And you say at some point in the book, in the afterword or whatever, that you would like for your daughters to be a part of Chicago, and you have every intention, you and your wife, of making them a part of Chicago.
Yeah, it is. You know, it's very interesting. As you know, my wife is French, and our two little girls happen to be Chinese. Happen to be. I mean, we adopted them from China. They just didn't show up one day. And, oh my God, darling! Look, they're Chinese. I'm sorry. You get enormously casual about this because they are our two little daughters, and for the most part, we absolutely forget that they are adopted. When our oldest girl, Elise, is going to turn 5 in April, began to write with her left hand. My wife is left-handed. I said, darling, look, she must get that from your side of the family. And we both burst out laughing, of course, because that's technically not possible. But it's very important for us. Certainly, our little girls are being reared speaking French because we want them to be able to speak to the French side of their family without any translation or any kind of awkwardness. We certainly want them to be aware of their Chinese heritage
right.
and be in touch with that. We certainly want them to understand and value that they are Americans. But it is also important, I must say to my wife as much as me, that they have a sense of identity as Chicagoans too.
Mm-hmm.
That they have some appreciation for the city's history, its sense of humor, its sense of boldness and adventure. And it's important to us that they have exposure to that, too. And, you know, so far they've certainly seemed to take to it.
But getting to the really important thing, what baseball team will they be rooting for?
You know, it's interesting because I am a Cubs fan, a lifelong Cubs fan, and our oldest little girl, Elise, is a White Sox fan.
Oh!
And look, you know, it's perfectly fine. It was the first World Series that she watched, and we kept her up every night because the White Sox won 4 games straight.
Right.
And so it became a super, you know, hey, baby, you helped him. You did it. So she goes, go Sox, go Sox. And it was 2 years ago. I was working on Windy City here in Chicago. We had rented an apartment. And a local alderman made it possible for us to march in the St. Patrick's
Day
Parade.
Oh, great.
And she wore a green and white White Sox cap that day. And she's been a White Sox fan ever since.
Great. And there is a scene in the book on a St. Patrick's Day parade that people, you know, be they from India or African American or whatever, there's something
yeah.
about St. Patrick's Day that everybody, it's the joyfulness that everybody was there in the parade wearing green, not thinking twice about it.
Yeah, I think St. Patrick's Day in Chicago, and it's been my impression, certainly also Boston and New York and a few other places, it becomes kind of a civic holiday for a showing of the colors and all the many colors that there are at a place like Chicago. The protagonist of my book, and since the reviews have been so nice and they call him a hero, I'm going to call him a hero.
All right.
Sonny Rapini, he's the alderman of the 48th Ward, becomes mayor, acting interim mayor on the death of the mayor of Chicago. Sonny is an immigrant from India, and there is a Hindu holiday called Holi, often depends on the calendar, the same time of the year. And green is, in fact, the kind of official color of that holiday. And Holi is a holiday in the Hindu calendar when you are essentially given license to do all the outrageous things that you're enjoined from doing for the rest of the year. So as Sonny explains when he's giving that speech to the city council, you know, my family first came here from India and we saw the green and we thought, gee, this is our holiday. They're even dyeing the river green. Look at this. And I like that scene where he gives a, he gives a talk about St. Patrick's Day in Chicago.
I do too. So how did you do a lot of research? You talk about Chicago being, you know, a city of the world. There are people from all over, but I don't know if you just know this because you've been a reporter for so long and you've lived in so many places in the world, but you really have a pretty intimate understanding of food associated with all kinds of backgrounds, with religious practices, with customs, with problems that people from different backgrounds may face with people from different backgrounds. It's how did you get all that?
Well, you know, you know a little of it, but it is research. And I must say, in many ways, that's the fun part of writing a novel like this. You know, if you could just go from doing the research, which includes talking to people and hanging out in neighborhoods and hanging out in neighborhood ethnic restaurants, which is the really fun part.
I'm sure.
If you could just go from that to the book tour, it'd be great. Unfortunately, there's this period called writing the book that intervenes because Random House, you know, wants people to be able to turn the page and see something on it. Boy, that part is misery. But the research part was absolute fun, and living here in Chicago and being able to take our then one little girl around, Elise, and seeing people react with her. And it was important to me. I mean, it is a novel, but I like to think, now that I'm writing novels, that one of the possible strengths that I can bring to the process of novel writing is the fact that I've had a rich career as a journalist, mm-hmm. very rich career. I've been mm-hmm. able to range all over the world. And I hope to be able to write novels that are about something, that just aren't navel-gazing inward, but about something, a situation, a place, mm-hmm. An episode, people. And so I take very seriously my responsibility, even in a novel, to describe a place, to let people inhabit it. Because I know I like to understand those things when I'm trying to give life and voice to a character. And I hope it understands, it helps a reader understand those things at the same time. And you know, it's a way, one of the many reasons we read novels, I like to think, is to transport us. And if the detail is good and true and telling in a novel, I think it can have that effect, even if you happen to be reading it in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you're a lifelong Chicagoan, you can read a book like that and say, gee, I never thought of a, look, how many people live in Chicago have never been to a Korean restaurant?
Right.
Quite a few.
Right, I'm sure.
Sure, although, because there's such a multiplicity of choices. How many people have ever been to a Chinese Salvadoran wedding? Quite a few have, quite a few haven't.
Not too many, I don't think, Scott.
Probably not too many,
no.
But I have a wedding in there. It's at a Chinese restaurant.
Right.
And it's between a young woman who is Chinese-American and the young man she marries is Salvadoran. Salvadoran American. And, you know, so even if you're living right next door to where the action takes place, I think it can transport you in the sense that it makes you notice something about where you live.
Mm-hmm. You also have, and this comes from years of reporting, too, and reporting on presidential politics and reporting on politics, a really keen sense of politics. I'm wondering, I grew up outside Chicago, and I'm wondering if there's something during the time of Mayor Daley, the first Mayor Daley, and I'm wondering if Chicago has kind of a unique style of politics, or if we're hearing about in this presidential campaign, you know, the old style politics in Philadelphia and in Pittsburgh, if there's something about big city old style politics that you can say it's in Chicago, but it's something that's true in many cities in this country.
I think it is something that's true in many cities in this country, although in Chicago it's a game that's played with particular vigor and often accomplishment and skill. I think that is, by the way, why you find, in addition to two candidates from Chicago who are now vying for president, Barack Obama, of course, who moved here, and Hillary Clinton, who was born here, or Rahm Emanuel, the Chicago congressman who's head of the Democratic National Campaign Committee, I believe, was at some official dinner in Washington the other night. I add this as a huge parenthetical, and he said the race in our party for the presidential nomination is between a senator from New York who was born in Illinois and a senator from Illinois who was apparently born in a manger.
Oh, that's funny.
It's a good line. And
yeah.
You know, it suggests to me, I think politics is a local specialty in Chicago, just like the blues and improvisational comedy.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot in common with the blues and improvisational comedy sometimes. But I think just like the blues and improvisational comedy are properties of Chicago that travel widely around the world and invite a lot of attention and imitation. I think that's true of politics, too. And I think that's why you find so many gifted national political reporters and commentators, you know, be it David Broder or George Will or David Brooks of the New York Times, have all spent time in Chicago. And it's also true why a lot of the people who run campaigns, Patty Solis, who until a few weeks ago was running Senator Clinton's campaign, is actually the sister of a Chicago alderman.
Oh, really?
David Axelrod, who is running Barack Obama's campaign, has run all of Mayor Daley's mayoral campaigns. So I think it's no accident, because you learn to play well in this league, and it makes you ready for prime time.
Yeah. And you were chief of the Chicago Bureau for NPR for how long, Scott?
Oh, I'd have to do the math, but like 7 years, something like that.
Uh-huh. And what was happening in Chicago politics at that time?
Well, Mayor Daley had died, and unexpectedly. And this led to a struggle for succession. Mike Bolandic was the 11th ward alderman of Mayor Daley's home ward, and he immediately succeeded him. But then you had the rise of Jane Byrne, who was often called the Snow Queen.
Mm-hmm.
And she had been a creature of the Chicago Democratic Organization, what we used to call the Machine. Although, as one of my characters says, if we still have a machine here, I wish someone would just show me where the off switch is. It's certainly not a machine in any way the way it used to be. And she ran against the machine and won. And then she was ultimately defeated by Harold Washington, who had also been a creature of the Chicago Democratic Organization. A lot of us can forget, given the profile that he had as a reformer, that Mayor Washington had actually been to prison before he was elected mayor for income tax evasion. Mm. Which inspired, I think, one of Mike Royko's great lines, where he said, if Harold Washington is elected, he'll be the first mayor of Chicago to be in prison before he was in office, rather than afterwards. And a beloved figure who died in his office, clearly, I don't mind saying, a vignette that was on my mind with the opening of Windy City, although I hope we talk about the character of the mayor, because I want it understood I'm not writing just a thinly fictionalized version of Harold Washington.
Right.
And so I was there for a period of what was sometimes called the Council Wars, great rivalry in the Chicago City Council between people who were representing various wards. And because you have such a vast city council here in Chicago, it's got 50 seats. New York has 51.
Hmm.
But in most cities, smaller city councils are much more common. So you really are the representative of a neighborhood, a community. You're viewed as often the representative of an individual fiefdom. And so you had, following the death of Mayor Daley and the breakup of his organization, you had a lot of people who had been standing around kind of waiting their turn, and suddenly they all had a chance to grab for the brass ring. Sorry about that stunning series of cliches, which I guarantee you does not reflect, I hope, the quality of the novel I've written. So it was a period of great rambunctiousness, and which, if I may, I remember fondly, because city council meetings were just big roustabout events. And it was undoubtedly, I think, at that particular time that probably my mind began to move around writing something one day.
Mm.
And what crystallized it is when God rest his soul, Mayor Washington died, there was an epical 18-hour city council meeting, 18 hours.
Goodness.
to choose his interim successor, Eugene Sawyer, who only served a couple of years, if I'm not mistaken. And, of course, Richard M. Daley, who's been the mayor more or less ever since then,
mm-hmm.
won the next election. But I will never forget that 18-hour city council session, up to and including the fact that they had to close the building because there were so much turbulence inside the floor, and then community groups that were meeting outside. And once they closed the building, on top of everything else, people couldn't go out and buy food. Now, food is important in Chicago. I have a lot of food in the book.
I think
in big cities, where people live in apartments, meeting in restaurants is a very common thing, getting together in restaurants. Restaurants become assets in the community. So I think it's absolutely a valid place to set an encounter between politicians who are meeting. But you have to understand, everybody was getting hungry and snappish there. And I will never forget, because it was in December, in the middle of the snow, people in City Hall crawling out on window ledges to bring sandwiches up, hand over hand, by rope, deli bags. And I thought, I will never forget that scene, and I said to myself, this is definitely the greatest city in the world. God, I love this.
And as the mayor is talking to Sonny, the early part of the book, he's talking about the importance of food. How can you say no? People are giving you food. You got to eat or you're hurting their feelings, right?
He's a man of famous appetites, right. My mayor in the book. And it's really not until 7-8 through the book that you understand he has a first name. Because everybody refers to him as the first mayor, just as the mayor. And then when a character does use his first name, you're a little shocked. It seems a little bit familiar that someone is no longer calling him the mayor. But he has famously expansive appetites. And as he says, "My God, man, I can't go to Chinatown and refuse the firecracker dumplings there because they think I've already filled up on the tray leches cake and pilsen." Nice. And he said, "Do you want another land war in Asia, man? Don't you realize the political dimensions of that?" And it underscored for me one of the things I learned spending time with politicians, trying to absorb some of the atmosphere around them to write this novel. One of the things I understood is that every little decision they make in their lives, every detail has some kind of political dimension. If a community group, if they spend Thursday night meeting with a community group in the basement of a Lutheran church and that group gives them a plaque, it's got to go up on the wall. Mm. Because one day someone who was there will come in, and if they don't find their plaque, they'll say, "Oh, why didn't you put our plaque up? You didn't like meeting with us?" Or if they meet with the Edgewater Citizens Council on a proposed change in zoning ordinances on a Wednesday night, and they don't show up Thursday night to meet with the Edgewater Citizens Council about installing a four-way stop on the corner of Wrightwood and Clark, the people in Edgewater get angry. You went to that community meeting, why not ours? You know, so it underscored for me that to be in politics, and I think especially at a level where you are so relentlessly exposed, aldermen don't have the retinue and covey of aides surrounding them that senators or congressmen do. It's at once the most self-absorbed kind of way to make a living, but it's also very selfless because your time is not your own. And you just cannot say to a community group, "I'm sorry, my daughter's in a school play that night."
Mm-hmm.
Because they will actually say, "Well, this is pretty important to us, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Don't you know there'll be another Christmas pageant next year, but don't you think installing a four-way stop? I mean, a lot of people have been struggling over this." And they really don't have a personal life. It's very difficult to balance that. And I think the pressure on people who, after all, are ordinary people, and that's one of the things we want them to be, is just extraordinary.
Right. So why not give free food, right? You got to have some kind of payoff.
Yes.
Yeah. Scott Simon is our guest. We're going to welcome phone calls for him. And here's our number, 800-486-8655. He has a new novel titled Windy City, a novel of politics, which is set in Chicago and is a great read. Scott is also the host of Weekend Edition on NPR on Saturday mornings. Great show. Lines are open. If you want to send us an email, you could do that as well. That's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Scott Simon, our guest, and we do want to tell you that he will be at Schwartz Bookstore on Oakland Avenue, and that's happening tomorrow night, Friday night at 7 o'clock. So he'll be reading from his book and signing his book as well. So those of you in this area may want to drop by and say hi. Our number, 800-486-8655. Nancy from Milwaukee, the first caller. Scott, hi, Nancy.
Good morning to both of you. A couple of years ago, Scott, on a Saturday morning, you did a wonderful dialogue with Dame Edna. It was so wonderful, and you kept saying, "Are we still on the air? Are we still on the air?"
I couldn't believe we were still on the air. Yeah, apparently we were, though.
I want to hear that again. The whole nation should hear that again. That is a part of Americana. How is it possible?
Well, Australiana or Britannia, I think, in this case.
That's true. Oh, I just want America to hear that again. It was just wonderful.
Well, I hate to present a commercial opportunity for anything other than my novel under the circumstances, but I believe that NPR, you know, NPR does market CDs, and I believe that's soon being offered.
On a comedy
CD that NPR is marketing.
Uh-huh. Oh, a comedy CD. That's great.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, how wonderful. So how will we know?
You know, I don't know that, and I may have spoken out of turn.
Uh-huh.
I mean, unlike my novel, which you can walk into the store and buy,
uh-huh.
I don't think you can quite do that with NPR CDs at the moment. You go, you know, you go through Wisconsin Public Radio.
I will make every effort because that was just priceless.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you. No, and it's interesting. I won't give away Dame Edna's best lines under any circumstance. But he Barry Humphries, the actor, she talked about her. Forgive me, the gynecologist with whom she traveled with was Julio Iglesias's father, who she said was, I believe, 92 and still a practicing gynecologist. And the next year, my wife and child and I, we were in France, and I picked up the English newspapers one morning in the village where she's from in France, and I read in the British newspapers, you know, Julio Iglesias's father, in fact, is a gynecologist.
Oh, my goodness.
And he was in his early 90s, and he had just married like a 41-year-old woman.
Oh, my.
So the premise of the interview that people thought was most outrageous turns out to be absolutely
true. Oh, my
gosh.
Oh. Thanks so much, Nancy, for your call. Lee from Caledonia is next. Hi, Lee.
Hi. Thank you. I heard a story about Mayor Daley that I was anxious to hear whether or not it was actually true. And the story is that the Queen of England evidently came to visit Chicago at one time, and Mayor Daley was introducing the Queen, and he said, "Ladies and gentlemen, the Queen." Is that accurate?
I don't think it is. I haven't heard that.
Okay. All right. I thought it was such a great story.
One has to ask, you know, which Mayor Daley at this particular
time. Yes, right. I think it was the original, the first, Mayor Daley number one.
No, I have never heard that. I don't think it's true. There was a previous Chicago politician, Hinky Dink Coughlin, and, you know, I doubt his mother named him Hinky Dink,
so I don't really know
what his name was. And supposedly, the story that is recorded by history on rather better authority is that the first Queen of England, I guess certainly wasn't Elizabeth, might have been Victoria, actually visited Chicago.
Right.
And supposedly he said to the people from his ward organization, "Nice to meet you, Queen. Queen, or Queen, these are the boys. Boys, this here is the Queen."
That's just as good.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Well, I'm anxious to read your book. Thank you.
Yeah, you'll enjoy it. And let's talk about the book for a moment here before we go back to phone calls. The hero of the book, is he thinking about the political dimensions of all of his actions, Scott, or is there something unique about him as a politician?
Well, I think any politician thinks about the political dimensions of almost everything they do. I describe at one point what his office looks like because he can't refuse to put up a plaque. And I think I describe items on his wall with sort of the political thought that went into putting him up there. There is something different about Sonny. I hope there's a lot that's different about Sonny in the sense that he served in the city council for 20 years at that point. He is not a reformer. He's been a very successful alderman within that system. As I explained to several aldermen who I would actually count as friends who count themselves as reformers, I'm sorry, outright reformers just aren't as interesting to write about as people who have kind of a germ of I don't want to even call it corruption, the germ of compromise in their soul. It's easier, in a sense, morally, to be a reformer that way because you don't have to live with so many implications. And as Sonny Rapini says, he'd never taken a bribe and never really been offered one, but that he tried to wear his virtue lightly, like a man who wears a clean white T-shirt to a spaghetti dinner. He's not boastful about it. But Sonny has suffered he's got two restive teenage daughters, and he suffered a terrible loss within the last year, which is that his wife was shot to death in a street crime, in a currency exchange in Chicago on Devon Avenue, and it was important to me to include this in the book and to have it kind of revealed in sections over the course of several days. You know from the beginning of the book, more or less, that Sonny's wife is gone, but you don't quite understand how it happened until, I'd say, the middle of the book. And it was something that I really wanted to do because I was struck by something Scott Turow, my friend, had said, who, of course, is a great novelist but a former prosecutor. And he had said that when a street crime occurs, a news organization, a great newspaper, will often take a look at the background of the assailant and will try and trace through his or her development and say, essentially, how could someone who was born an innocent baby turn into a killer? And he says that while this is a necessary question for society to ask, he says, what a shame we don't devote as much attention to tracing back the effect that vicious, unprincipled, spontaneous crime has in the life of the family who suffers the loss. There's often less of that, and so I wanted that I wanted the presence of that plot point in the novel too, because it softens Sonny. It makes him even more anxious than usual about his daughters and how he's going to provide for them in the future. It underscores for him the fact that he has spent a lot of time with strangers, as people in politics do. And you inevitably ask yourself, why have I been spending all of this time with strangers, even though I think the work is important, and not as much time as I probably should be spending with my family. So I wanted that tug on Sonny's heartstrings from the first of the book.
Mm-hmm. Ralph from Stoughton, hi.
Hi. Scott, I grew up in Chicago on the northwest side. I remember listening to Big Ernie on WJJD, and then seeing him.
That was my father, Big mm-hmm. Ern. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I know that.
And I have a bartender named Big Ern in Windy City.
Oh, well, I just wanted to ask you, if it would be too impertinent, how your dad influenced you and your life as a radio journalist, because he had that ability to make you feel like you were special when you were being talked to, and I think that's one of the gifts that you bring to your role whenever you're on the radio, or when I listen, or hopefully when I get a chance to read your book on the Windy City. Thanks
oh.
for all that you're doing.
Thank you. I think it's very difficult for anyone to really answer in a coherent way how their father influences them. I was 16 when my father died. So a lot of it wouldn't necessarily be influenced by firsthand observation. And my father was a comedian. Well, this is a political comedy I've written. It's a comic novel, but I've spent most of my career being ostensibly serious. At least that was the general idea. I can't answer that in any way that's really coherent, except to say that, you know, my father influences everything, absolutely everything that I am. And if there is, if there's one note that gives me great pleasure, because, you know, it must be said, my mother, God bless, to whom this book is dedicated, and without getting graphic, she was sick when I was working on this book, and it just gives me great pleasure that you know, she's able to see this. Mm-hmm. My mother is going to turn 80, and my father was even older, so the number of people who remember actually hearing or seeing my father is obviously dwindling, but it gives me great pleasure that so many people who remember my father talk about, you know, that he was funny, that he was outrageous, that, you know, what a character, but they all get back to what they recognize as a quality of kindness, that he was kind to people. And that, of course, gives me great pleasure, and I think there's no greater gift.
Right. Thank you so much for your call. We go to Heather from Brookston, Minnesota. Hi, Heather.
Hi there. Hi, Scott, or Mr. Hi. Simon, whichever. I just have to tell you, I've wished for years I could say thank you for all the both serious and hilarious things you've brought to us over the radio and other forms. But there are a couple things, many things came in mind while I've been listening to you this morning. One of them, of course, is Daniel Shore. And when you and he talk on Saturday mornings, I just treasure that. I set my alarm clock to make sure I'm not going to miss it on Saturday. And I'm always disappointed when he's not there, because just the rapport you two have together, besides how important what both of you have to talk about each time, is, you know, really impressive. But one of the fun things I look forward to when it happens is when you talk with Daniel Pinkwater, and the two of you read a short story or a story mm-hmm. together that's supposedly a children's story. And so many of them I could actually name for you, but one of them in particular, because you get the giggles. I mean, you two are just little boys reading these stories.
It's impossible not to.
And I went out and bought many of them, and they were for me, and I'm almost 58. But Henry Builds a Cabin was based on Thoreau's, you know, building his home on Walden Pond. And I went out and bought it because it was such a wonderful story, and you had such fun reading it. Little did I know, about 2 years later, I ended up buying land out in the country, and Heather has now built a cabin almost based on Henry's story, and it was just such fun to have heard that book. So I just want to thank you for all the many blessings you bring to us.
Thank you.
You know,
That's very kind. You know what's interesting? Our two little girls far prefer to have their mother read to them than they do me. And my wife will sometimes say, darlings, you don't understand. This is Daddy does this for a living. She reads you the book, but they prefer to hear it from their mother.
Does she read in French?
Yes, she does. Well, she can read English, too, but yes, she reads to them in French. Yeah. It's rare for her to read to them in English.
Mm. Well, maybe they just prefer French, Scott. It's not you at all.
Oh, boy.
It's language.
All right. I like the sound of that.
Yeah.
Thanks very much.
All right. Heather, thanks so much for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. Scott Simon is our guest this hour, and he is the author of Windy City, a novel of politics. It's his second novel. He, of course, the host of NPR's Weekend Edition on Saturday mornings, which is a marvelous show and has been with NPR for – and PBS has just done solid, wonderful work for many years. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number is 800-486-8655. Scott Simon is our guest, and we go to Sean from Boscobel. Hi, Sean.
Hi. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Enjoying the program totally. Originally, I came from Chicago, grew up in Chicago politics, was in it since I was 5 years old. When I came up to Wisconsin, it was kind of hard because you have that political junkie thing going, and it was hard not to get involved as avidly as I did in Chicago. One of the comments I had was you were talking about food and the correlation with that and politics, and I was just amazed when I was in politics at how willing the restaurants were to donate to functions and to work with political functions. And it was all restaurants. I love Chicago food. I still go down to their restaurants. So, you know, basically, I'm not even sure if that's still prevalent there because it's been such a long time since I've been in politics there. But like I said, I was just amazed at the correlation between the restaurants and politics in Chicago.
Well, yeah. Sonny in the novel is a restaurateur, right?
He owns a restaurant. He owns runs an Indian restaurant, which he takes over. I don't want to say inherit because that makes it sound like some great national treasury, but he has to take over the operation of his restaurant when the restaurant family restaurant when his father dies. And his last name is Rupini, which is he's an Indian immigrant, and that's a Tamil name. And people in Chicago, he comes to Chicago during the first period of Indian immigration, substantial Indian immigration in the late 70s. And so people are, you know, the name Rupini, although Tamil sounds like it could be Italian. So people in the early days in Chicago before that many Indian immigrants would come up to Sonny and say, you know, kid, name like that, dark as you are, you must be Calabrian or maybe from Sicily.
Hmm.
And so he makes it a point as he grows older and takes over the restaurant to include a couple of Italian specialties on the menu, which he calls Sonny Rupini's Italian Specialties. And he becomes kind of known for his sense of humor and congeniality, and the restaurant becomes a neighborhood meeting place, and he makes it a point to kind of reach out of the ethnic community among Indians and bring in bar and bas mitzvahs, and even at one point brings in a swingers club, because he says, you know, people who do that must appreciate an 8-course buffet on Sunday of Indian delicacies. And that becomes his political base. That's how he becomes a known commodity. And so when he, at the same point in time, he's, you know, the restaurant business just kind of isn't big enough for him, at least neighborhood restaurant, and that's when he runs for city council and begins a political career. So, yeah, he sees the world in those terms, but he's, as a restaurateur, the kitchen aspect is less interesting to him, although he can make dosas, which is something I learned how to do when I was researching the novel. Worked a couple of days at different Indian restaurants, one in London and one in Chicago. But he, you know, it's the enterprise of running the restaurant that he likes, because after all, when you run a restaurant, even of modest size, you're dealing with people's lives. You know, their problems become yours. And it's one thing that I can't help but note, when I worked at an Indian restaurant at Brick Lane in London, the people doing the serving outside and the owners were Indian and Bangladeshi, but the kitchen help were Poles and Ukrainians. And in Chicago, this is a terrible generalization, but at the restaurant where I worked for a couple of days, the family that owns it and runs it and the servers on the serving floor were Indian, and the kitchen help were Mexican and Salvadoran, which gives rise to Indian. I just think it says something about America. Indian waiters coming into the kitchen and saying, dos Marcelo Manda, por favor, to the kitchen help. So I treasured the time that I spent there. And, you know, food is all about congeniality and warmth and sharing.
And are you a good cook?
My wife is a great cook. I can make a few things, although more Mexican than Indian. I can make dosas, which I learned how to make. They had me working the line kitchen which I'm sure is some kind of union violation, if not a health code violation, although I was properly clad. And I made about 50 doses on a Sunday afternoon, and nobody sent them back, to my knowledge. But all that being said, what really you need for are these fermented churns that churn the flour literally for 24 hours, and it's almost impossible to really have one in your kitchen.
Hmm. Thanks, Sean, for the call. DB from Madison, hi. Hello?
Hi.
Hello?
Hi, go right ahead.
Hello?
We're right here, DB. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Scott?
Yes.
This is DB Mayberry.
How do you do?
I just want to be sure, Scott, that book includes your learning spot in Uptown.
It includes my what spot in Uptown?
Your learning spot, DB?
What?
Your learning spot, is that what you said?
Was Uptown.
Oh, my learning spot was Uptown. When you said learning spot, of course, I'm married to a French woman, and I wondered if you were describing some kind of erogenous zone or something. yes, it is. I mean, he's the Sonny Rapini. My character is the alderman of the 48th Ward, which in Uptown, I think, fairly, you would divide between the 48th Ward and the 46th Ward. So there is a lot of Uptown in there. Mm-hmm. There's Wilson, there's Lawrence, there's Ainsley, there's Argyle. Those are all streets on the north side of Chicago. Yes, absolutely. He is one of Uptown's aldermen.
Thanks, DB. Elaine from Richmond Township. Hi, Elaine.
Hi, Scott. You're taking me back like 50 years. I grew up in the Lincoln Park area, and so did my children. And the hippies invaded Chicago in 1968, the elections. And we always went to the playground off Clark and Armitage every day. And during that time, I took the kids over to the playground, our neighborhood playground. It was so filled with tear gas that we couldn't stay.
Well, my novel is not historical.
Right.
It's set in a parallel universe. Is there any tear gas? I don't think there's any tear gas.
There's no tear gas
in my book.
No.
It's describing a happier time.
Right. Those were some times. I remember those years in Chicago. Those were some times.
And they're indelibly written in the history of the city and what it is, as far as that goes.
Yeah.
But I'd have to rummage my mind, but I don't think I have much reference to it in Windy City, but I think it's something that's imprinted on the minds of everyone who was there. But, you know, one thing that I was eager to set this novel in a parallel universe and have it going on now, and, of course, most of the people who live in Chicago do not have a direct firsthand memory of that. And the immigration has been so great into Chicago, this truly is an incident of history for, this would be a rough guess, but, you know, more than 50% of the city.
Thanks very much for the call. I wait till somewhat toward the end of the hour to ask you this, but I have to ask you this so it didn't dominate the hour. But tell me about the place of Trinity Church in Chicago.
Tell you about the...
The place of Trinity Church in Chicago.
You mean
Barack Obama's church?
Barack Obama's church,
right?
Well, you know, I can't pretend to be an expert on that. And more to the point, since I've been on book tour, I did not hear Senator Obama's speech the other day. My wife thoughtfully clipped it aside for me to read. So I've been on tour, and I really can't pretend to be any kind of expert on that.
Mm-hmm.
Or even have a working knowledge of it. I mean, it's you know, during a campaign season, it's one of the places that candidates go to be seen because they have a huge membership. But as to, you know, and the Reverend usually delivers some nice little speech introducing them, and, you know, including candidates with whom he has no truck. And I'd never heard that he was particularly truculent or anything. So I really just don't know about that. I just have been out of touch. When I'm on book tour, I'm a novelist, and But also, I should say that I've been with my wife and two kids. So the part of me that's not a novelist, the first responsibility is, you know, bringing our little girl, getting the breakfast in the morning, and that sort of thing.
Yeah,
so,
I just thought maybe historically it had some place in your reporting from there.
No, I have a scene set in Windy City in a church that clearly is modeled on a couple that I've been to here in town, and my wife and I went to services there, and they're extraordinary shows and very moving to see the evidence of faith there. But you know, certainly we felt absolutely comfortable there. Our mixed ethnic family and were treated with elaborate courtesy, and it was just great, great warmth. Our little girl, Elise, who I guess at that point was like almost three, she went into the kids' Bible session that they have, and we have never seen her squirming less or better behaved than she was there. It was just extraordinary. And I'm not sure it lasted for more than a few weeks, but for weeks thereafter, she would say, "Who do we do it all for? Jesus."
Scott Simon is our guest. We go to Tom from Verona next. Hey, Tom.
Hey, yeah. We had a visiting scientist from France, and Scott, you enjoy this. Our time placed him because we had to get an apartment where we could walk home for lunch. But we asked him what he wanted to do. He just wanted to go to Chicago, and which made me think, God, these people all the way from France, and you know, what a great city Chicago really is, because here in Wisconsin, we kind of look down our nose on Chicago.
Yeah.
Because we take it for granted. But the first time I was in Chicago, I went to a bowling tournament in college quite a long time ago. I went to a bar in Lincoln Park, and so ethnic that I went in, and the bartenders, you know, talked to us, and finally says, "Well, I'm sorry, the girls aren't here. They're indisposed, so I clean it up a little bit." But then in northern Michigan, yeah, it was always, "Let's go to Hurley," you know, back in the 60s. And well, that was Chicago's summer place, you know.
Yeah.
Because they had that character, gangster character up there.
Oh, in Michigan, you mean?
Yeah, upper Michigan, yeah.
Probably more than one.
Well, Hurley was a famous place where they kind of set up shop in the summer.
Oh, that's right. That was like a spa vacation for members of organized crime families, if I'm not mistaken.
With a B in.
A summer place for them, yes.
Yes, yes, right. And, of course, the locals would say, when the bar's closed, we go to Hurley, you know, and get a little Chicago action.
Thanks, Tom, so much for your call. We have a couple lines open if you've been trying to get through. A couple minutes left, 800-486-8655. 227-2050 if you're joining us in Milwaukee, 227-2050 for you to be a part of our conversation with Scott Simon. Are you doing anything more? I know that you did the PBS narration on Lincoln. Is anything in the works for this year for you concerning Lincoln?
You know, a couple of things which I just superstitiously don't want to talk about, but yes. Absolutely, with a couple of talented producers, and I hope that comes about. You know what it's like in public broadcasting, Kathleen.
Right.
Sometimes by the time you get the idea signed off on and the funding in place, it's 8 years later. So.
This one's got to be this year, though, right?
Because yes, I know. Lincoln. There is that drawback. But right. I think there's a feeling that there is, to say the least, a perceptible increase in interest in things Illinois. And people drawing that link. I mean, it's certainly one of the reasons why Windy City is coming out now when it is. And,
right.
So, yes, I certainly hope we are able to get that
right.
done because you're very, very proud to be a part of that.
Yeah.
And, I have narrated Copeland's a Lincoln portrait with, you know, I think in a half a dozen cities at this point with different orchestras. And it's always just a great honor on the mere contrivance to the fact that you're from Illinois. To be asked to read those words.
Yes, right. You know, I love Lincoln. I'm from Illinois as well, and I'm always proud. I always bring him up, but I am. There's something to be proud of, to be from Illinois where Abraham Lincoln was. I know that's kind of a stretch in a way, but
well,
it's so true.
It is. You know, at one point in Windy City, Sonny Rupini, somebody is trying to dazzle him with some political offer and says, you know, if this works out, you could run for statewide office someday. And Sonny says, "Oh, that's, you know, I don't think that would happen." And, you know, in southern Illinois, they think Rupini is some kind of a malodorous Italian vegetable. And a woman who is a real wheeler-dealer politician kind of brings him up short and says, "Sonny, this is Illinois." You know, sort of like it. She goes on to say, "We have our hatreds here, but this is Illinois."
Mm-hmm.
And it, you know, reminds us of the fact that, you know, in fact, Barack Obama is the second African-American senator to be elected from Illinois in recent years. You know, Illinois, I believe, elected the first Jewish governor many years ago, Henry Horner, which is not to say there's not often certainly a disgraceful stain of racism in the history of Illinois and really any other state. But at the same time, there has been this, even in the rough and tumble and give and take of politics, there have been these moments, I think, of that have a kind of sterling quality. And so when she says to him, "This is Illinois, Sonny," it's a good way of reminding him that you can't use that as an excuse. And as a matter of fact, she goes on to say, you wouldn't let your two daughters use that as an excuse.
Yeah. Thank you, Scott, so much for being with us. Thanks for the book.
My pleasure. Thank you, Kathleen.
Scott Simon, his book, and it's his second novel, has just been published, Windy City, a novel of politics. And Scott will be at the Harry Schwartz Bookshop on Oakland Avenue tomorrow at 7 o'clock, Friday, March 21st at 7 p.m. for a reading and a signing of his book, Windy City. He has written, well, he's done a lot of writing. His other novel is Pretty Birds. And he's also the author of Home and Away, a memoir, Jackie Robinson and the Integration of Baseball. And as I said, the novel Pretty Birds. You hear him on Weekend Edition on Saturday mornings on National Public Radio with a terrific program. And he says he has something in the works about Abraham Lincoln on the bicentenary of his birth. So we'll look forward to that, whatever it may be, sometime this year. This book, The Inner Workings of Chicago Politics, It's a mystery, and it takes in a really insider's look at how Chicago politics works. It's good. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing this hour, and thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee for your calls. We appreciate them, and thank you for them. News is coming up from National Public Radio. We will be with you again tomorrow morning from 9 to 11 to talk about interesting topics. I'm Kathleen Dunn. It's a minute before 11, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.